This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Dick Ringler of English and Scandinavian Studies. Today is December 3rd, 2007. Dick, we wanted to pick it up here, I think, basically around your conversion to Buddhism.
Right. That's a good point to start. And that takes us to 1973.
Okay.
That's when this happened. I'm going to read you. I gave a quite elaborate slide illustrated talk called Buddha and Mao about my experiences in China when I went there in 73. The talk was given in 81, so the talk is dealing with things that happened, what would be 8 years earlier. I'll come talk later about the talk, but what I'm going to read you now is a thing called Introduction to a Public Talk, 1981. Before sharing with friends and strangers a little of what I saw and experienced and thought during my brief pilgrimage this past August to the People's Republic of China, it will be helpful to establish my point of view by saying a few words about my spiritual life and my conversion to the Zen school of Mahayana or Northern Buddhism. I use that awkward word conversion because it is the only word that really serves, though I want to make it clear that my own experience has never been particularly dramatic, and certainly has not run to colorful incidents like the one that befell St. Paul on the road to Damascus. Rather, my conversion, if I may call it that, has been an ongoing, lifelong process, natural as breathing, and, I see in retrospect, inevitable. It was not out of the way to mention St. Paul a moment ago, since, according to my teacher, I myself was a Christian monk in a previous lifetime, perhaps even my most recent lifetime. I have no memory of the episode, hence no way of determining whether my teacher's words are historical or figurative. But I know that they are true in some sense, for they embody an intuition I have had myself. Where did I go wrong in that last lifetime? What did I do to warrant being reborn as an English professor in this one? On these points, your guess is as good as mine. I must have had a terribly lax and slipshod practice in those days. I have a hunch that the scene of this fiasco was somewhere in Ireland, probably County Kerry. Anyway, the entity who is, in a sense, speaking to you tonight, and who will refer to itself conventionally as I throughout this talk, entered upon its present career in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1934 and spent its formative years in a non-religious household. My father was a lapsed Catholic, lapsed since his teens. My mother was of no religious persuasion, as far as I could tell, and I received no specifically religious instruction or training in childhood. Naturally, I absorbed my father's unspoken skepticism and agnosticism, and this attitude was reinforced by what reading I did. When I was in junior high school, my mother suffered what was whisperingly referred to as a nervous breakdown. Recovery from this was accompanied by a violent and vehement conversion to Jehovah's Witnesses. The Witnesses are, as most of you know, a sect famous for energetic proselytizing, and my mother now brought the full fervor of her missionary zeal to bear on myself and my younger sister. I can appreciate now, decades later, that love was her chief motivation, since, as she saw it, our eternal salvation or damnation hinged on her success in bringing us around. But of course I did not see it that way at the time. I was entrenched in agnosticism by then, thank goodness I was, and anyway, I was entering the time of life when it is vitally important to distance oneself from one's parents' views and work out one's own. Erik Erikson says somewhere that the adolescent mind is essentially an ideological mind. Mine certainly was. It still is. Between my mother and myself, there now arose desperate struggle. A number of quite trying years followed, years which left me deeply suspicious of religious enthusiasm in general and strenuously opposed to proselytizing that involved any element of psychological or other coercion. This was the point at which I went off to college in the early 1950s. In college and later in graduate school, I did some very foolish things, I confess, like reading all 6 volumes of John Dryden's collected plays. No doubt I would have spent my time a lot more wisely and constructively by being the lover of many women. What old Professor Dowden always wanted to be, he once confessed shyly to the poet Yeats. I chose to read 6 volumes of Dryden's collected plays instead. Other activities of this kind, only slightly less absurd, eventually earned me an A.B. degree and then an M.A. and a Ph.D., and I came back home to Wisconsin to teach in the English department at the University of Wisconsin. I got married about this same time, and my wife and I had children, and in this way my 20s and early 30s passed away, all in a dream, as it were, all in a dream. Then some 15 years ago, there came an acute crisis in my personal life, a crisis that overtaxed my psychological resources and overturned my well-developed system of hiding places. It was a period when I seriously considered suicide, and it brought me ultimately and reluctantly and desperately onto the couches of the psychologists, for whose help I remain grateful to this day. It was during this crisis that I stumbled in the usual quasi-accidental, quasi-providential way across my first books on Buddhism. I remember reading Alan Watts, D.T. Suzuki, R.H. Blythe, 3 illustrious war horses of nascent Western Zen, and finding very attractive the wares of oneness they purveyed. I had no inkling, of course, what oneness was. Even today I try not to have too many ideas in my head about that. And although the Zen readings inspired me for the moment and implanted seeds for the future, they did not seem to lead anywhere in what was then the present, and I passed on to other books and other ideas. From the years that followed, those were the heady, roiling years of the Beatles and the war in Vietnam, I remember one thing worth mentioning, my nodding acquaintance in faculty meetings with Richard Robinson of the Department of South Asian Studies, whose tragic and unexpected death in 1970 affected me very deeply, as did the memorial service conducted for him by Tibetan monks. I attended this service as the result of a most fortunate coincidence of outer accident and inner readiness. Well, to make a long story short, in England, in the summer of 1973, my wife and I, both at another crisis in our lives, took what we judged to be the fairly innocuous step of attending a series of talks on Buddhism at the London Buddhist Society, talks given by the celebrated Christmas Humphreys. Soon afterwards, we took 2 quite large and decisive steps. The first of them, and what a natural, self-evident, inevitable, easy step it seemed then and still seems today, was that we became vegetarians, by which I mean we ceased to be agents or accomplices in the killing of other animals. The second step, and how difficult, hazardous, threatening, and bizarre it seemed at the time, was seeking instruction in how to cross our legs and sit in Zen meditation. It is a difficult moment for most people, I think. In adopting the posture of the Buddha, one takes one's first step towards adopting the mind of the Buddha. And for this reason, sitting in Buddhist meditation is somewhat analogous to reciting the Nicene Creed in Christianity. It is the first moment of real commitment, a scary step, a real challenge to the old agnostic, a scandalous apostasy on the part of the ancient Irish monk. The meditation hall was on the 2nd floor of the London Buddhist Society's quarters in Eccleston Square, near Victoria Station. And the first time we went there to join a meditation group, I remember climbing the stairs to that 2nd floor in panicky dread and peering through a doorway at horrors, just what I feared, an altar, grinning idols, reeking incense, etc., etc. At the doorway stood a short, balding Englishman in a pinstriped suit, essence of normalcy and respectability. Thank God. In the nervous, rapid-fire voice adopted by American males, or adopted by me, when they are scared to death and don't want to show it, I barked out, "Who's in charge here?" "Why, you are," said Mr. Normalcy. It was the late Basil Sladen who was guiding this meditation session for beginners. "I'm in charge? Really? Me? Why didn't anybody ever tell me this before? Who's in charge here? You are." Back in the States that autumn of 1973, my wife and I felt it was a matter of life and death to follow up what we'd begun in London. But we did not know where to turn. I was beginning to investigate the possibility of studying Zen in Japan, either throwing up my job at the university or trying to get an indefinite leave of absence and supporting myself in Japan by teaching English, when we learned of the existence of a Zen group in Madison. It turned out to be an affiliate of the Zen Center of Rochester, New York, founded by a well-known American Zen teacher who had trained for many years in Japan. His name was Philip Keplow. We joined the Madison Zen group, and later the Rochester Center, and after a suitable interval, I applied to become one of Roshi Keplow's students. And since then, for an appreciable part of my life, for the past 7 years, in fact, I have been trying to work on myself in the prescribed Zen way under Roshi Keplow's direction. An odd karma and a very zigzag path had brought the old Irish monk home at last. Keplow, who's most famous for a book called The Three Pillars of Zen, was a war reporter, courtroom reporter who took a job, applied for and got a job as one of the court reporters at the Nuremberg trials, war crime trials after the Second World War. And the things that he heard and saw at that trial were one of the things that pushed him into deciding he had to study Buddhism. It's a fact that, you know, wars, I often go to a monastery in northwest Iowa, or just across from Dubuque, place called Piasta. There's a Cistercian monastery, New Mellory Abbey, and my wife and I sometimes go there for holidays and other things like that, and we learned there that there are, after a war, there are a huge number of vocations of monks, new vocations at Christian monasteries. People come back from those wars just devastated and with PTSD and every kind of imaginal thing wrong with them, and a number of them take the route of going into monasteries and taking up spiritual paths and so on. That's what Keplow did, getting back from Germany after being a court reporter at the war crimes trials there. He then applied to become a court reporter at the Japanese war crimes trials, which took place later than the German ones. Mm-hmm. And it was there that he first became, when he was in Japan, that he became interested in Zen Buddhism and the effect it had on people who practiced it. So I studied with him mostly, sometimes here in Madison at the local group, sometimes every other month or so going out to Rochester, New York for a week or two and continuing my studies there. Zen training, it is. An important ingredient, you do sitting and meditating a certain number of hours per week, and then you go to these intensive meditation sessions, which are called seishin, a Japanese word, where you sit and walk and etc. in complete silence with about 40 other people for a whole week. The only talking is done by the teacher, who gives sermon-like things called teisho once a day during the retreat, and also once a day, or more than that, two, three times a day, you go up and talk to him about how you're advancing in your meditation practice, how it's going on. It's vaguely analogous to Christian prayer, not completely analogous, and you talk about him, how your practice is developing and so on. As a monk in a Christian monastery in Europe in the Middle Ages, might have gone to his abbot and talked about his problems and so on. The sort of dialogues you can read about in the earliest records of Christian monks from the Egyptian desert, where a lot of these things are preserved. I spent 10 years very intensely in this kind of Buddhist practice, and since then it's been much more lax, much more calm. But 10 years going to these seishin and meditating intensely, what's the point of it all? The Buddhism was originated in India and was brought to China by a monk called Bodhidharma in Sanskrit, Dhammo in Chinese. And then it was taken from China to Japan by a monk named Dogen. And it's the Japanese version that developed in Japan after Dogen brought it, I think, in the 13th or 14th century, that's developed into the Zen that's known today. Mm-hmm. Dogen was asked repeatedly during his life in Japan, what did you learn in China? You spent years and years and years and years studying at a Chinese monastery. What did you learn during all of that time? And Dogen would almost invariably say, I learned that my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical. Zen teachers loving often these semi-whimsical, obscure statements about what it's all about. I learned that my eyes were horizontal and my nose was vertical. That's what he learned in China, he said. Well, then, one day, talking to somebody else in a different context, he let the cat out of the bag, in a sense. Somebody asked him, what did you acquire in China during all those years of intensive meditation there? And he said, a tender heart, which is a very different kind of answer to that sort of question. So I was practicing, and all sorts of things, interesting things happened. For example, what I now regard as a tragedy. I had the notion, Zen Buddhism didn't insist that I did this. I think it was too much residual Christianity. I had the notion that I would have to destroy the old me, in other words, for the new me to be born. And one day, in pursuance with this, I burned all of my poetry, all of my earlier poetry, 20, 30 years of poetry, including a couple plays written in verse, my huge sonnet sequence to my high school girlfriend, and all sorts of other things. All of it went up in the chimney, in the fireplace, down in the living room, and I sat there crying, weeping like a little baby about what I was doing and felt I had to do, but burning it all up. Some of it was later recovered by getting it back out of letters that I'd written to friends earlier on, but a large part was completely destroyed. The old me went up in flames, my personal sort of holocaust or auto-da-fé, in order that the new me could be born. This was a dumb thing to do, and my pursuit of Zen Buddhism led me to do a couple other dumb things, which I'll get to in a moment. One of the revelations that came to me as I started reading about Buddhism was a book about English literature by an Englishman who had studied Buddhism in Japan and been interned by the Japanese during the Second World War. And he wrote a book called Zen in English Literature and Oriental Classics, which is a completely, it's an unknown book. Nobody reads it. Nobody knows anything about it, partly because it was published in Tokyo in 1942, which was not good for books in English. But it gives a completely different and unusual approach to English literature, sort of a Zen approach. And it was in reading his book there, in which he talks about the writers in English and American who most exemplify the spirit of Zen, that I came across, years after I had read his first books and in a completely different context, Robert Louis Stevenson, whom he regards as one of the, not the books that everybody's familiar with by Stevenson, but other things of Stevenson. He regards Stevenson, along with Shakespeare, as exemplifying better than anybody else the spirit of Zen in English literature. And I'm going to read you one tiny little thing. It won't last long at all. This says it all, in a sense. At the end of his life, Stevenson wrote a bunch of fables. And these fables are often quoted by Zen teachers in their sermons and talks and so on, because they do exemplify certain aspects of the Zen attitude towards life very, very clearly. This fable, it's in prose, it's very short, it goes by you with the speed of an express train. It moves so fast and touches on its ideas so quickly. It's almost like a poem. You'll see. The sinking ship. Sir, said the first lieutenant, bursting into the captain's cabin, the ship is going down. Very well, Mr. Spoker, said the captain, but that is no reason for going about half-shaved. Excuse your mind a moment, Mr. Spoker, and you will see that to the philosophic eye there is nothing new in our position. The ship, if she is to go down at all, may be said to have been going down since she was launched. She is settling fast, said the first lieutenant, as he returned from shaving. Fast, Mr. Spoker? Asked the captain. The expression is a strange one, for time, if you will think of it, is only relative. Sir, said the lieutenant, I think it is scarcely worthwhile to embark in such a discussion when we shall all be in Davy Jones's locker in 10 minutes. By parity of reasoning, returned the captain gently, it would never be worthwhile to begin any inquiry of importance. The odds are always overwhelming that we must die before we shall have brought it to an end. You have not considered, Mr. Spoker, the situation of man, said the captain, smiling and shaking his head. I am much more engaged in considering the position of the ship, said Mr. Spoker. Spoken like a good officer, replied the captain, laying his hand on the lieutenant's shoulder. On deck, they found the men had broken into the spirit room and were fast getting drunk. My men, said the captain, there is no sense in this. The ship is going down, you will tell me, in 10 minutes. Well, and what then? To the philosophic eye, there is nothing new in our position. All our lives long, we may have been about to break a blood vessel or to be struck by lightning, not merely in 10 minutes, but in 10 seconds. And that has not prevented us from eating dinner, no, nor from putting money in the savings bank. I assure you, with my hand on my heart, I fail to comprehend your attitude. The men were already too far gone to pay much heed. This is a very painful sight, Mr. Spoker, said the captain. And yet, to the philosophic eye, or whatever it is, replied the first lieutenant, they may be said to have been getting drunk since they came aboard. I do not know if you always follow my thought, Mr. Spoker, returned the captain gently, but let us proceed. In the powder magazine, they found an old salt smoking his pipe. Good God, cried the captain, what are you about? Well, sir, said the old salt apologetically, they told me as she were going down. And suppose she were, said the captain. To the philosophic eye, there would be nothing new in our position. Life, my old shipmate, life at any moment and in any view is as dangerous as a sinking ship, and yet it is man's handsome fashion to carry umbrellas, to wear India rubber overshoes, to begin vast works, and to conduct himself in every way as if he might hope to be eternal. And for my own poor part, I should despise the man who, even on board a sinking ship, should omit to take a pill or to wind up his watch. That, my friend, would not be the human attitude. I beg pardon, sir, said Mr. Spoker, but what is precisely the difference between shaving in a sinking ship and smoking in a powder magazine? Or doing nothing at all in any conceivable circumstances, cried the captain, perfectly conclusive. Give me a cigar. 2 minutes afterwards, the ship blew up with a glorious detonation.
How fascinating, Dick.
It seems lightweight, but it's very deep. It cuts
it's
very...
It's very...
Yeah, deep. Yeah.
I didn't know Stevenson wrote that.
No, these are not read. He's a Stevenson who's not well known. I wanted at one point, I'll come briefly to this later, to write a book about the ethical, spiritual dimension of Robert Louis Stevenson, and I compiled a whole drawer full of research on it and so on, but nothing ever came of it because Stevenson is not regarded as a serious, worthwhile author among literary critics and English professors nowadays. He's an author of boys' books, with one book maybe, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which stands out above all of those, but Kidnapped, Treasure Island. This is entertainment for young men and not really literature. Well, he's a very great author in his own way, dealing with the sort of issues that he deals with in that thing there. That's that little fable. Anyway, I learned about his fables, and I found that particular one that I just read you electrifying when I first read it. And I wrote a poem about his death, about Stevenson's death, which I'll read because I like it. This was after I'd studied him for a long, long time and read everything he'd written, more than Dryden's collected plays. There's some 26 volumes of Stevenson's writings. The Death of Robert Louis Stevenson, 1894, begins with a quotation from a book about him by his stepson, who was living with him in Samoa, which was where he was living at the end of his life, because he had pulmonary difficulties, died at 45, 46 or something like that, quite young. He'd had maybe TB or pulmonary difficulties most of his life, and ultimately he had a cerebral hemorrhage in Samoa, which killed him. At sunset he came downstairs, rallied his wife about the forebodings she could not shake off, talked of a lecturing tour to America that he was eager to make, as he was now so well, and played a game at cards with her to drive away her melancholy. He said he was hungry, begged her assistance to help him make a salad for the evening meal, and to enhance the little feast he brought up a bottle of old Burgundy from the cellar. He was helping his wife on the veranda and gaily talking when suddenly he put both hands to his head and cried out, "What's that?" It was this cerebral hemorrhage. He was dead a few minutes later. A moment in Samoa, on the verge of what we fools call change. Mother and son, each busy at the play of being mother and son, husband and wife at endless odds, wrapped in their task of being one. Innocent, bystanding sun and trees, heaven and earth trembling on edge like a thin coin, grief that haunts the mind a lifetime, almost revealed, but unrevealed, unborn. Salad on the sideboard, breathing bottle of wine, supper and sleep ahead, everything everlastingly ready in the kingdom of this moment and the kingdom of the dead.
When did you write that one?
Oh, this will be when I was in my, when I was really working a lot on Stevenson, which will probably be in the late 70s or early 80s.
Okay.
Back in Madison, in my own Zen career, we had a Zen, we had a house in Madison. We still, the Zen group, there was something called the Madison Zen Group, and it had a big house on Jefferson Street, and which is south of Monroe Street. And we spent a lot of time working on that house. It was an old house when we bought it, and it had to be painted on the outside and all prettied up and so on the inside. And one aspect of Zen practice is a lot of work, like in any monastery. You have to do a lot of work on the monastery and on its grounds and things like that. And so we did that, and for a number of years, I was the leader of this Zen group, and we had sittings on two nights of the week and a Sunday morning sitting as well. And we had ceremonies and whatnot and so on. And we wore Zen outfits to the degree that there is such a thing. We had lots of interesting experiences. The zoning authorities wanted to know whether we were a church or not. People in the West often have difficulty with non-Western religions figuring out what they are and what they're up to. Were we a church or not? Well, if we were a church, we needed to redo all the plumbing to bring it up to code, and we had to have a parking lot that would accommodate 20 cars or so instead of just a driveway that would accommodate four. So we hired a lawyer and claimed that we were not a... the lawyer taught us how to do this. We claimed we were not a church. As the lawyer argued in front of the zoning commission, they sit around thinking. How are they any different than a bunch of guys getting together on Thursday night to play poker? That's what they're up to. And the zoning commission bought this line, and we weren't classified as a church, but just as a private house with a group that met in it. And so we didn't have to do any of these unbelievably expensive things, like right, replumbing the house and building a huge parking lot and so on. At one point during the talking with the lawyer asked me a question which Buddhists are often asked. He noticed that there was an altar in our meditation room with an image of the Buddha sitting on top of the altar. And he said to me, do you guys believe in God? And I gave him the answer which a lot of Buddhists will give to that particular question, which is, Buddhism has no concept of God as such. Buddhism has no concept of God as such, which leads me to one more brief poem that I want to read you. Buddhism has no concept of God as such.
Is that the name of the poem?
Lord of screams and belly laughs, wrong numbers on the telephone, right numbers too. He is the one who made and wields the world as such. Despair is incense in his nose. Blood is bright saltness on his tongue. He rises with the moon, blooms with the rose, sets with the sun. Sits next to Bach at the organ, the Samaritan woman at the well. Hangs himself with Judas, stokes the fires at Auschwitz and in hell. Bestriding Bethlehem and Calvary, colossus of hopes and fears, who is he then? He is the tree that falls in the forest and the no one there who hears. I'm still a Buddhist. though not as active as I once was. I'm still a vegetarian, have been ever since my decision to go that particular way. Any religion can lead its followers into excesses. In the early days of my Buddhism, I took this do not kill other creatures so seriously that once when we were visiting my wife's folks' place on Washington Island, I decided that I simply, those little woolly bear caterpillars, you know, the ones that are brown at both ends and black in the middle, they were coming out of their eggs or whatever. They were all over the roads on Washington Island, and you couldn't drive for 20 feet without running over a bunch of them. And that brought me the same discomfort as driving late at night in the spring when all of a sudden soon the windshield is spattered with the corpses of bugs and so on. Some religious people, not Buddhists, but some religious people in India, you know, make this the rationale for never killing any animals, never being in areas where there are bugs like that and so on. So I got this bee in my bonnet that I couldn't kill any more little black and brown woolly caterpillars like that. And so I drove home at around 3 miles an hour, missing all of the caterpillars on the road and not killing a one of them, and getting home way, way, way after dark, having spent hours in the drive. And when I told my teacher about this during one of my interviews at Rochester, he just laughed. He laughed uproariously. He thought it was one of the funniest things he'd heard recently. You know, I'll tell you one more story he told us, which exemplifies a lot of things. A lot of American professors used to go to Japan to study Buddhism, and they came there thinking that they knew a lot about it theoretically. They knew what Zen Buddhism. They'd read the appropriate books, and they knew all about the appropriate ways to think about that religion, if it is a religion. Some people will say it's not a religion, but a philosophy. Anyway, American professors always used to go around instructing Zen abbots in their monasteries about how they should be meditating and what they should be thinking and so on, because the American professors knew it all theoretically from the book. And my teacher told the story of one such American professor who went to a monastery in Japan, and he was put in a guest room, and he discovered that it was a long, long walk from his guest room to the lavatory. And he, after doing it a couple times, took 45 minutes to get through this long monastery. It took a long time to get from his guest room to the lavatory. After a little while, he realized that he could let himself out a side door of his room into the monastery garden and piss there against the trunk of a convenient tree. And he did that for a while, and then one day the abbot called him in and told him that it had been reported to him that this American guest of the monastery was standing there going out in the middle of the night and pissing in the monastery garden. And the American said, yeah, that was true. And the abbot said, this is not a behavior that we encourage or approve of at all. American professor said, well, sir, isn't it true that in Buddhism one thing is as good as another, and there's no difference between anything you do, and there are no rules and so on? So if I want to piss in the monastery garden, I can certainly do it. Whereupon the abbot slugged him.
Oh, that is a good story. I like
that. You like that one? Okay. Anyway.
Dick, can I ask
you, sure.
As you are moving so profoundly into Buddhism, how is that affecting your work at the university, if at all?
It's affecting it in the sense that I'm teaching all the things that I taught before. Beowulf is a very deep poem with a lot of spiritual stuff in it. It was written by a Christian monk, probably. And so I was very happy teaching Beowulf and sort of calling attention to the ethical content of it, its attitude towards killing and that sort of stuff. I was a little more uncomfortable teaching courses on the Vikings, who were just nothing but mayhem all over the place and killing and so on. But I did it. You know, it was literature. It didn't affect my teaching very much at all, except I think that the teaching became deeper in a way, and dealing with deeper issues in the works I was looking at. Ultimately, I stopped doing this very intensive meditating and going out to these sesshin and so on, partly because it was taking up so much time, and partly because I was beginning to feel that I had, how shall I put it, that I had internalized the teachings of Buddhism to the degree that I wanted to or felt necessary for myself. So I'm still a Buddhist and I still meditate, but I no longer do it at all as intensely as I did in those days. I'm still a Buddhist, still a vegetarian. I'm eternally grateful to the changes that Buddhism brought about in my life. And I believe, though I don't think I'll ever find anybody to agree with me, I believe that violence among human beings is never going to be brought to an end until people give up killing and eating animals. I think that the sort of daily violence we witness in advertisements for Thanksgiving turkeys and killing of cows and whatnot, the daily violence that we witness and condone against other animals is something which we all too easily turn against ourselves when the moment comes. Anyway, that's the hard core of what I wanted to say about Buddhism. In May of 1974, I got one of the university's Distinguished Teaching Awards, which was nice. And I began publishing articles on various Icelandic subjects, which had begun to be generated in me. In 1976, the summer of 19, we got Bill Courtney and Nick Doan of the English department, and I got the idea for putting together a teen-taught course on monasticism, on the origins of Christian monasticism, which go back to the Egyptian desert in the second and third century A.D. And we got a big grant from I forget who to prepare that course. It was team-taught in the sense that we all three got payment for that was what the grant was all about. Normally, you know, you can't pay three people to teach a single course without a grant. And we got the grant and we split up the grant among ourselves and we assigned ourselves different aspects of monasticism to work on the summer before, justify the research, provide the research angle. I got assigned the task of doing a lecture, preparing a lecture or a couple lectures on the physical the physical side of monasticism, what a monastery was like, what it was like to live in community with a bunch of other guys, and what sort of art and artifacts early Christian monasteries produced, and Christian monasteries in general. So I chose, knowing a little bit about it, Ireland as the place that I would spend that summer, because Ireland, Ireland is full of monasteries. It was back in those days, and it is now. And one critic has said that nowhere else on earth probably was the culture of a people so much embraced within monasticism as in Ireland in the Middle Ages. There are still some functioning monasteries, and then there are a lot of just shells of walls and so on. And we went, my wife and I and my two kids, we went to Ireland for the summer, rented a car, traveled all around the place, taking pictures of everything, stone crosses, those famous stone crosses, and the monasteries and the towers, the round towers, which were a defense of the monasteries against the Vikings when the Viking attacks began. We spent the whole summer absorbing Irish culture and so on, even renting boats occasionally and going out to some of the remote islands off the west coast of Ireland where some of these monasteries were built because the monks wanted to get away from the world, and no better place than to get away from the world than to go to an island in the middle of nowhere and build your monastery there. We came back and gave this course, and I got very interested in Christian monasticism because, in a way, any sort of intense religious, meditative, prayerful activity is similar to all the others. They have very different theological views about God and so on. But what you actually do when you're meditating or praying or something like that is quite similar in all of these different religions among the Sufis, for example, in the Mohammedan branch of things. And anyway, we gave this course, and I got interested in Christian monasticism. We took the class as a class project.
Undergraduates or graduates?
Undergraduates and graduates. Mixed, both. Mixed, yeah. One of the things that we insisted that they do, well, we didn't insist, we couldn't do it, but we very urged them to do it. We took them all down to... we made the option of, for them all possible, of going down in a bus to Conception Abbey, which is a Catholic Benedictine monastery in northwestern Missouri, a sort of great cultural center. It runs a seminary as well, and it has a schola cantorum, a choir where the monks still sing in Latin according to the old traditional Gregorian chant. And we went to this monastery, and everybody spent 4 or 5 days there. To get them into the life of the monastery, we had them do exactly what the monks were doing. They had to do jobs. They had to do work jobs around the monastery a couple hours a day. And then we had talks and whatnot and so on, and instruction of various kinds. And this was a big success, and everybody enjoyed it.
Who took this course? What kind of people?
Students in history, medieval history, medieval literature, people who were interested in spiritual matters, Catholics in Madison, but other people as well as Catholics, who were somewhat, and then people who were just interested in what went on in monasteries. A lot of people, some people took it because they thought it was crazy. I mean, what do monks do? They shut themselves off from the world, they go off onto an island off the west coast of Scotland or something like that. They severely restrict their diet, and they don't drink, and they don't have anything to do with women, and they read holy books, and they meditate. What's all of this about? And you can't say to them, well, they discover that their eyes are horizontal and their noses are vertical. That doesn't make any sense to them. Mm-hmm. I think they do understand the tender heart business of any of these spiritual practices, to develop yourself in certain ways. So I took the kids there. In Ireland, this monastery in northwestern, I'm sorry, I discovered that one of the monasteries we went to in Ireland, Mount Mellory, which we just visited briefly, has a daughter house in northwestern Iowa, though I mentioned it earlier, at Piasta, New Mellory Abbey. And I started going there, and so did Karen, and we would talk with the monks about this, that, and the other thing. I never considered converting to Christianity for a long time, because I had since my run-in with my mother about religion many years before, I was horrified by the thought of saying a creed, of saying I believe X, Y, and Z, and believing it, and I couldn't, I've always been the sort of person who can't say anything that I don't believe, and until I believed all of that stuff about the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and so on, I couldn't say it. I couldn't say I believed it unless I really did believe it. So that prevented me from ever getting interested in Christianity or Christian monasticism. In Buddhism, Buddhism doesn't put up barriers of that particular kind. You don't have to acknowledge or confess any things at all. Then one night at one of these meditation retreats in Rochester, one of these intensive Buddhist meditation retreats, one of the things I realized at a sudden moment of insight, and you get a lot of insights at these retreats, one of the things I realized was that this whole refusing to say the creed, believing I couldn't say the creed unless I absolutely believed everything I was saying, was some kind of shadow playing with myself, that it didn't make any difference whether I believed it in my heart or soul or not. I could still say it if I wanted to. It's not hypocritical, this perception or this insight. It's rather more, Stevenson at the end of his life wrote a he and his wife, sitting in Samoa, decided they would put together a cookbook. Stevenson would write, she would collect the recipes and figure out the recipes, and he would preface each of the recipes with an anecdote, or a little very, very short story, a paragraph story about the subject of the recipe. This never came to anything. He died before they'd got very far with it, but a couple of them survived. And one of these anecdotes is about how in Egypt, during the beginnings of Christian monasticism, Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria, who is the author of the Athanasian Creed, which preceded the Nicene Creed in Christianity. Christians have been fighting about creeds since the beginning of time. Bishop Athanasius was exiled from Alexandria for a time, and he came with his followers to the little island monastery of Tabanezi in the Upper Nile. And he got off the ship, and the abbot of the monastery came out with some followers, and he was a famous man, Athanasius. He'd invented the Athanasian Creed, which was the statement of belief of all Christians at that time. They welcomed him and said they were so happy to have him there. And as he got on towards supper time, they couldn't find him. He had vanished. And they went searching for him all over the island, and finally they found him sitting around a campfire in front of a cave, sharing a simple supper with a hermit who lived in the cave. And the abbot said, "Oh, my lord bishop, why have you done this? We were going to give you tonight a great, huge feast with wonderful wines and wonderful cuts of meat and all sorts of other things. And here you've wandered away to the other side of the island and are eating with this dirty hermit a bunch of eggs and vegetables and scorning our great feast that we're going to make for you. How could you demean yourself and insult us in this way? And my lord Athanasius, the inventor of the famous Athanasian Creed that's known throughout Christendom." And Athanasius said, "Any fool can write a creed. It takes a genius to make a good omelet." Anyway, this is Stevenson's attitude, you know, of... It's a very religious attitude in its own way, though yes. It seems to be... anti-clerical or anti-religious organizations and that sort of thing. Anyway, I did a lot of interesting things at that monastery in Iowa, and discovered some things I wouldn't have known the value of. One of the great Catholic saints is Saint Ignatius of Loyola, and he developed a set of spiritual exercises which could make you... they have to be done in groups, small groups of three or four people, and they develop your spirituality. The one I only participated in one while I was down there, but it was mind-blowing. You role-play. You get three guys sitting around a table, and you role-play the roles of people in one of the New Testament miracle stories. This was the one we were doing was the by the pool of Bethesda, which is somewhere in the Holy Land, Jesus cured a man who couldn't walk, a lame man who was lying there by the side of the pool. And the people doing this exercise do is one of you plays the role of the lame man who is lying by the side of the pool. Another of you plays the role of Jesus coming in there and talking to the man. Another one plays the role of the spectators, the people who are seeing all of this happen and the effect it has on them. And it sounds as if it should be kind of tedious, but what happens if you really get into it in the right kind of context is that all of a sudden you find yourself being the role you're playing. And in a sort of a funny way, and it turns into a live thing with three or four people interacting in terms of this story. It's a very interesting device for making those Bible stories, even just on the surface, making those Bible stories of the New Testament reveal their meaning and come alive as real existential, real life situations.
Did you and Bill Courtney and Nick Doan teach this course more than once?
We did it twice, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very time consuming. Then it was done later. I dropped out of it because I wanted to do other things.
But there was student demand for it, I take it.
There was a sufficient enrollment to justify its existence.
Uh-huh.
The only course I've ever taught which had huge student demand is the nuclear war courses that I'll be coming to in a moment. I mean, there was student demand, but this was, you know, it was a respectable course with a respectable enrollment and enough money for a TA and all that. Mm-hmm. It was a very good course, I think. We had to do print up a lot of things that weren't in any books and so on. Anyway, in 19... 78, partly as a result of the things I've been talking about, I read Stevenson's Fables on Wisconsin Public Radio, WHR, Wisconsin. I've done a lot of reading of things on Wisconsin Public Radio, and I've been on University of the Year more times than I would care to shake a stick at. And I'm not mentioning all of those and the particular things that they were about, but all of the subjects I'm interested in that I've been talking about and others that I'll still talk about became subjects that I talked about with Emily Auerbach and Norman Gilliland on mm-hmm. University of the Year. So I read Stevenson's Fables and people like that. It's 1979, I became the chief editorial consultant for the Time Life book on the Vikings, which is probably, you know, of anything I've ever done, acquired the greatest circulation, because it just, they sell those books, you know, to everybody. I was the chief editorial consultant there, corrected all of the scripts and so on. And this being in that series led to other things later, other articles on the Vikings.
Did you enjoy that work, Dave?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, you know, it isn't original. It isn't doing anything original. It's all a compilation from serious books about the Vikings and so on. And it's for the popular audience. But it has nice illustrations. Mm-hmm. And it introduces people to the Vikings in a responsible way with illustrations that adequately show what they were like and what their culture was like, what the Viking archaeology is like. Two months ago, I got called to read an article on the Vikings, which was built partly on that book, written by the staff of the leading Brazilian popular science magazine. So this gets all over the place. These Time Life books get all over the place. Not this one, but not just this one, but all of them. In 1980, I got together with that one was actually given. We'd been working on it for a while. I got together with Bill Courtney again and Jane Schulenberg from the Extension. She teaches monasticism and women's monasticism for continuing studies. We co-sponsored, the university co-sponsored with the St. Benedict Center out across the lake, which sure. It was a retreat center in those days. Yeah. It's now changed its name to Holy Wisdom Monastery mm-hmm. and functions on a different basis. But that was the 1,000th? Oh, 480. The 1,500th anniversary of St. Benedict of Nursia's birth. And it was a big thing in the whole Catholic world. He was the founder of Western monasticism, the sort of monasticism that's still known today. So they wanted to hold an event to honor him, and they contacted Bill and me about it, and Jane, and we put together a marvelous four-day-long conference out at the Benedict Center called Benedict and Scholastica. Scholastica was St. Benedict's sister, his real-life sister. And it was a marvelous event, and everybody who went there was much moved and enlightened by it.
Was this a national conference? Did you get
it? It was an international. The speakers were international figures, experts on the Egyptian desert and on monasticism and on spirituality. The audience was mostly people from the university and people from medicine and Catholic religious people from all over the state, you know, priests and nuns and, mm-hmm. and whatnot. It was a very big event and very, very, very well received and very well done. In August of 1981, that was the year after that, my Zen teacher, Roshi Kaplow, organized a pilgrimage to China, to mainland China. He wanted to see, it's in China that Zen Buddhism developed before it was taken to Japan, though its roots go back to India. He wanted to go to China and investigate the status of monasticism, of Zen monasticism. We had long been told by the Chinese that they respected all religions, and that these Zen monasteries were all open and functioning just like Christian churches were throughout communist China. And I don't think we believed that very much. But anyway, Roshi Kaplan wanted to go there and see what the situation was. We were very lucky to get permission to do this, because this was before things were opened up the way they are today. It was much more closed there. And if people went to China, they wanted to show them rug factories and other things, you know, kind of China's might as an industrial power, up-and-coming industrial power. They were not the least bit interested to having people going around to monasteries of 1,000 years or so ago, but especially people who might cast a critical eye on them. Mm-hmm. But we went. He and Roshi Kaplow and about 15, 20 of his students. We went there for, I think, 2 weeks. We started out in Beijing, and then we took a route through some of the monasteries, the old monasteries of China, Shaolin Temple, for example. That's where this guy from India, Bodhidharma, originally settled and taught. The Chinese called him Da Mo. Shaolin Monastery later was the origin of Kung Fu, the martial art. But we went there because he had been the founder of the monastery. Hmm. And we climbed up the mountain, the not very high mountain behind it, where he had his cave, where when he wanted to be like a hermit and more intensely meditative, he would go up to that cave, and it was full of inscriptions and other things. That was very, very interesting to see it. We decided a lot of the point of when advanced Buddhist teachers get together, they try to sort of suss out one another's degree of spiritual accomplishment. And so Roshi, our teacher, was always interested in finding out whether these Chinese abbots at these state-run Chinese monasteries were legitimately spiritual people, or whether they were just frontmen for the regime. And it turned out that they were frontmen for the regime. These temples were being run as sort of parks or national things for tourists, Chinese tourists, to go to, but had no real authentic spiritual life or spiritual practice. I took from this trip to China, I took hundreds and hundreds of slides, and other people who were on it took others. And I put all these together after I got back to Madison and gave a lecture, put together a lecture called Buddha and Mao, which is one of the best lectures I've ever put together, a huge number of slides. We went to the cave temples. In the north of China, there are huge temples cut out of the rock in cliff faces. And in them sit Buddha statues, sometimes quite huge, which have also been cut out of the rock. The whole living rock has been hollowed out to make these temples with Buddha images still standing in them. And they're painted. And we went to a number.
Like Bamiyan was.
Like Bamiyan was, exactly. Except these are later. I've seen Bamiyan in illustrations, but the Bamiyan showed these in an earlier stage of development as Buddhism was making its way from India to China. But that's the same thing exactly. That was a tragedy, incidentally, that happening. Fortunately, the Chinese are pretty alert to the value of their cultural heritage, and they look after these things in China itself. So we went to a number of those temples. We spent days doing that and taking pictures. I put together this lecture called Buddha and Mao, which was designed to, my idea, in addition to explaining Buddhism in China and what Buddhism was about, was to sort of suggest that Mao Zedong, his mother had been a Buddhist. And my idea, my theory, which I still believe, is that a lot of his interpretation of Marxist doctrine was colored by his mother's Buddhism and by the compassion towards other people that Buddhism encourages. He was also a poet, and I sort of got into his poetry and put some of that into the lecture. It was a very good lecture. I gave it I gave it once in Madison and then once again in Minneapolis at the department there of whatever it is at the university. And I never gave it again, which has been sad for me in a sense, because I've produced some public lectures in my time, which I've given 50, 75 times at various places around the United States. But there wasn't much call for this one. Buddha and Mao just didn't have a natural audience. The thing about the experience in China which most affected me personally was the populousness of the country. There's no place in China. We started out in Beijing, and we ended up in Shanghai. There's no place in China that you can go, unless it's up into the mountains where these temples of early monks were, where there aren't millions of people around you all the time. Privacy is practically impossible to find in China in the cities. The streets were at that time just full of bicycles. Now they're full of cars, I'm told. I haven't been back, but the streets were full of bicycles. You couldn't get away from other people anywhere, which has a sort of a funny psychological effect, not to be able to get any privacy at all, to have people around you all the time. So I was aware of that particularly, and we came back home, and over Christmas, the following Christmas, Christmas of 81, I went out with my wife to visit my and my kids, to visit my parents in San Diego. They were living there then. And my father had retired from the Milwaukee Journal some years before and moved out to San Diego. And we were driving out to San Diego, and I'd begun to start reading things about nuclear weapons and nuclear war and so on. And I remember setting out for, well, it takes 3 days to drive from Madison to San Diego via Denver. And I was thinking about nuclear weapons and nuclear war. I'd been cued into the subject during the summer because the Chinese have built elaborate nuclear bomb-proof shelters in all their big cities. And they claimed at one point that the whole population of Beijing could scurry underground into shelters if they needed to, if there were danger of a nuclear attack. Well, a fact like that makes you aware that this is more than nuclear attacks, is more than just make-believe. Here there are people who are taking the possibility of it very, very seriously. And we drove out to visit my folks after the summer, after Christmas, after I'd been in China. And we went through Nebraska, as usual. And Nebraska is where a lot of the missile silos on the American side are located. And I had made the mistake. I usually read. My wife would drive half the way and I'd drive the other half. And while she was driving, I would normally read. And I made what turned out to be the mistake, or maybe it didn't, of reading a book by Nigel Calder about the nuclear arms race. Very sort of accurate but sensationalistic book about what would happen if we and the Russians attacked each other with nuclear weapons. The Chinese, I had learned during the summer, were convinced that this was going to happen. They were convinced that the Russians and the Americans were going to go at one another with nuclear weapons, and that's why they had built these huge bomb shelters. And as we were driving through Nebraska, my wife was driving, and I was just sitting there, I think, next to her, reflecting on this Nigel Calder book, when all of a sudden, I had a... I can't really be sure whether it was a dream or whether it was a vision or what exactly it was, but all of this stuff started went together in my head, and driving along the middle of Nebraska, all of a sudden I had the experience of being in the middle of a nuclear war. They were launching missiles all around us from these silos, and they were heading towards Russia. And presumably the Russians were doing the same thing. It was a waking dream, was a waking dream in a sense. And when it was over, I was scared to death. I was scared to death by it. When it was over, and I came back to when we got to Denver, probably, I had. I was convinced that this might very easily happen. And I was going to dedicate myself to doing as much as I could to see to it that it didn't happen. Because it struck me as just insane and evil and everything else that you can imagine. And I think I was particularly struck by the... I mean, we and the Russians, it's fine if we blow each other up. We hate each other, and we've developed these weapons. But between the two of us, we're going to do in all these billions of people in China who don't have nuclear weapons at all, but we're going to bomb their big cities, according to Nigel Calder, because that's what you do in warfare. And I was just appalled at the prospect of all of this. And so, for the first time in my life, I really decided I was going to have to get off the... I was going to have to stop being a passive spectator and a skeptic and so on and all of that, and get active and do something active to stop this to the degree that I could. Now, I believe that all of this came out of the Buddhism to a large extent, and the anti-violence ideas of Buddhism that I've been working with for a long time now. Anyway, I decided I was going to have to exert myself to see what I could do along with other people to stop this. So in the spring of 82, I read somewhere that a group was meeting in Boston to try and start a nationwide organization of educators modeled on Physicians for Social Responsibility and called Educators for Social Responsibility. And they were having an original meeting in Cambridge, in Boston. So I went there. I was at that meeting, and I suggested to them, as everybody was talking about, what shall we do, what can we do? And I said, well, what I'm going to do is go back to Wisconsin and start a local organization of educators statewide. A statewide organization of educators at all levels, primary, secondary, college, and so on, to fight against this possibility of nuclear war. And when I got back, and so how we founded WESR, Wisconsin Educators for Social Responsibility, it was called. And when I got back here, I started talking to people, a professor at Marquette, whom I got to know about, some middle school teachers in the Waukesha and Milwaukee area, and then a lot of people in Madison that I knew, and we put together this organization called Wisconsin Educators for Social Responsibility.
Any of your colleagues from Scandinavian Studies or English, were they interested?
They were interested, but they didn't get actively involved in it. I mean, my colleagues in English, we'd got rid of the politically active ones in the department. My colleagues in Scandinavian Studies, quite wisely and pragmatically, didn't want to get involved in anything involving the politics. They were all citizens of Norway and Denmark and whatnot. And they didn't want to stick their heads up doing something unpopular in America. And I can certainly understand that. No, I felt that, and I didn't blame them for that at all. I said, This is something that Americans have got to do, and we hope that we have friends in Russia who are doing the same thing over there, with vis-a-vis their government. And there were people like that in the medical profession, at least, working Russians and Americans working side by side. Anyway, we started this organization, and I came back, and I spent a lot of time working on it, and organizing the state. I think that I was encouraged in all of this by the idea of by the Wisconsin idea and the idea of statewide activities, though I was applying them in a different sort of area. One of the people who founded the organization with me was a middle school teacher in Waukesha. He's now the mayor of Waukesha. Incredible that a sort of essentially left-leaning person should become mayor of that very, very conservative town.
Indeed.
Very, but he, and I don't know whether he'll get reelected, but he's very, very capable and very good. Anyway, he wrote me a letter a couple of years after we founded this organization. I want to thank you for your wonderful keynote address at our spring conference. People really enjoyed it and it sparked a lot of good discussion. Also, thanks for being the catalyst behind WESR. It has touched more teachers and students than you realize. Which I really liked. I thought it was good getting that letter. I then decided that we needed a course at the university on nuclear war and nuclear war issues. A consciousness-raising thing. In all of these things that I got involved in, there was never any... we avoided, you know, preaching, proselytizing. What we simply tried to do was make people aware of the enormous issues involved and of the dangers that people were facing. And, of course, we assumed that if they knew what was going on, if they knew the truth, if they knew how dangerous the situation was, they would be prompted to agree with us that nuclear weapons should be done away with, and the arms race was crazy foolishness and so on. So I decided we needed a course at the university, and that was the origin of this course, which was given three times, called Perspectives on Nuclear War. And that's what it really was perspectives on the whole issue. It was a team-taught course. I was fortunate in getting the support of Dean David Cronin to do this. But, of course, everybody was very anxious about nuclear issues at that time. I mean, Ronald Reagan, our president, had talked about them.
Oh, this was the Star Wars
time. Yeah, the Star Wars and the feasibility of nuclear war. Nuclear war is a possibility and we'll win it and so on. And that scared people to death. So everybody was aware of the issue in general terms. But what I wanted to do, and my colleagues, was educate people about it. So we put together this team-taught multidisciplinary course, team being anybody at the university who had any professional knowledge of this subject. So we began with, you know, physicists, nuclear physicists, and people from the scientific side of things who explained the history of working with atoms and how these weapons were developed and what their effects would be and that sort of thing. And then we brought in all sorts of guest lecturers. In the first year, we had somebody from the Russian embassy, one of the diplomats there, to come and give us the Soviet perspective on all of this.
I'm surprised he was willing to come.
He did. He came.
Was it a good presentation?
He was a very smooth guy. We also invited somebody from the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which was in charge of our, you know, weapons program, more or less. We had to have somebody from our side to give our side, as they had giving their side. What was really funny about the Russians' visit, what was his name? Yuri something or other. We had him here. I had to shepherd him around campus. I took and showed him the Capitol, which he was very impressed by, the Capitol building, the state Capitol, which is an impressive building. And then we had him to dinner with a couple other people, the political science and so on. And he was here for, I guess, one night and gave his talk and left. About 3 weeks later, I was sitting in my office in Van Hise, and there was a knock at the door, and a guy in a black suit said, could he speak to me for a moment? And it was, guess who?
Somebody from the CIA or
the FBI. It was the FBI. There'd been a lot of publicity about this course in the papers, in Madison and statewide, and he wanted to talk to me about it. And I told him everything, you know, I was perfectly straightforward and said that, you know, this guy hadn't visited anything that should alarm anybody, and he gave his lecture, and he was very smooth and very slick, and probably half of the audience of students believed what he was saying, and the other half didn't, and he left again, and it was all over, and we had him to dinner, and I explained all of this, and what we'd done, we took him to the state capitol building, and so on, and then the FBI guy said, taking out his pad of paper, could you give me the names of the other people who came to this dinner party with him? And I said, no.
Of course.
Of course not. Of course not. And I said I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't tell him that. And he said, okay, that's fine. And that was the end of the whole thing. But it was eye-opening.
The whole
It was eye-opening. And so we had the people from the sciences departments, and then people came from, and these guys from the embassy, and political scientists and arms control people from the poli-sci department and the law school to talk about the legality of nuclear weapons. And we even had the United Methodist bishop come in and the Catholic archbishop to talk about the just war theory and the morality of using nuclear weapons. It was a quite amazing course.
It sounds quite complex and rich and challenging.
And challenging, yeah. And it was all machine graded because it, the multiple choice machine graded because the questions were going to cover so many different areas and grounds and fields of human knowledge and so on that we didn't feel that we could have any TAs or so on who would be competent to read all the answers. So at least by putting together a very careful machine gradable exam, we thought that we would be covering that. It was a very popular course and it was repeated twice more with different staff to some extent, but the same pattern.
Now, did you lead the creation of that course, Dick?
Yeah.
And how?
And I introduced all of the speakers, which I think is absolutely essential in a team-taught course taught by a whole raft of miscellaneous people. There must have been 25 different faculty members participating in it.
How did you do that? How do you go on a subject like that? How do you go about at the university doing that? How do you get physicists and political scientists and historians and physicians and how do you do that?
You find out people who are concerned about this subject and interested in this subject, and you do that by phoning around, and one person leads to another person. Paul Boyer in the history department,
yes.
He was one of the people on the original staff of the lecture on this course. And from history, Don Reeder, the chairman of the physics department, participated in the course. Connie Blanchard, who was a chemist, nuclear chemist. And then people from the medical school. It's a very distinguished guy, what's his name, who did a lot of work on long-term radioactive damage from the Hiroshima bomb in Japan.
Not Seymour Abramson.
No.
I know who you mean.
Well, he lectured. He came in and he lectured and so on. And, some of the people in the course, some of the lecturers in the course, were sort of my mind that this is all appalling. And others, sort of took it just as part of the day's work. I mean, these were the weapons we developed. We dropped them on Hiroshima, Nagasaki. These were the results. They took a quite objective approach to what was going on. You find out who's interested, and then you call and invite them to do it. And some will. Most of the people that had been fingered for me by others were willing to do it and wanted to do it. A few turned out not to be interested. One physicist who had been active in developing nuclear weapons didn't want to touch it. Of course, I could understand why. And that's the way you do it. And if you get people together. I put together the original syllabus myself, but with the aid and advice of all sorts of other colleagues. I got help from the people in Madison has a quite active chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and that got the medical people all involved in this course and what was going on. And then I could call other people around the country to get advice occasionally on speakers. And then there were, I think, movies. There were a couple of movies and so on. Anyway, that's the way you do it. But it was essential to get the dean's support.
I was going to say, did you talk to Cronin first?
I did. I talked to Cronin before I invested a lot of time and energy into it because it had to go through. We have in the timetable something called interdisciplinary courses. a slot in the timetable called interdisciplinary courses. Mm-hmm. And in order to be given, they have to be approved of the dean, by the dean, but then they have to be approved by, in this case, all three divisional committees.
Oh, my.
Social sciences and humanities and physical sciences as well, because it trespassed on all of their territory. And I would think normally it'd be very hard to get three such committees to agree, except the dean was behind the course and approved the course. And that made all the difference in the world, of course. Mm-hmm. We gave it three times, and it became quite well known around the country.
Was it groundbreaking? Was there nothing like it elsewhere?
I don't think there was anything really very much like it. You'll get some sense in a moment, I think, of how groundbreaking it was. It was publicized locally in the Wisconsin State Journal, and that got it all around the state. And a couple colleges in Wisconsin developed similar courses, team-taught courses. Carroll College in Waukesha, for example, out of their own faculty with their own faculty expertise. Rounding up presenters was hard, but I was able to do it. One day I was in my office and the mail was delivered, and there was a letter there I could see from the return address from the Board of Regents. And I said, uh-oh, now we're in trouble. And I opened it up, and it was from the president of the Board of Regents, who is a doctor by the name of Ben Lawton.
Oh, up in Marshfield.
Turned out to be a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and he wrote the longest, most effusive letter saying how glad he was that the university was finally doing something useful.
Really?
In effect, that's...
Do you still have that letter?
No, I don't think I do. Not you, I'm paraphrasing, but yes. Something important, something really important the university was being done. He later spoke at a... That was his attitude. I mean, he took this issue very seriously, and he supported this course and endorsed this course. We invited him to be the keynote speaker in a conference we gave not long after that, which I'll tell you about. And in his, he gave a keynote address as president of the Board of Regents, and he threw out this. The attendees were faculty from all around the state at colleges and universities, and the theme of his little brief introduction was, "Here's an opportunity for you." We were trying to organize another statewide thing, which I'll tell you about. The theme of his introduction was, "Well, now here's a chance for you guys, you academics, to put your money where your mouth is on this particular issue. And not just talk about things, but to do something." He was a remarkable guy, mm-hmm. Ben Lawton was.
Yes.
Anyway.
This would be the mid-1980s, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mid-1980s. Dick,
I have to ask as well, working on this course, did you have to get leave from your two departments to spend time on it?
The dean picked up one equivalent of one course. I got credit for one course of teaching doing it. It was enormously more time consuming than that, of course. But you know, I had a huge commitment to doing it. And he at least gave me that. Well, he was tremendously supportive. It was marvelous. But that's how it was done. I was relieved of one of my courses in either English or Scandinavian studies. I forget what. I wrote an article for the Journal of College Science Teaching about this course. And just, you know, what the syllabus was, what ground we covered, what the rationale was, what subjects of all of these lectures and so on. And I got asked then, on the basis of that article, to write an article for Academe, which is the Journal of the American Association of, the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors.
Oh.
And
it's called Academe?
Academe is the name of the journal. Okay. It's our official thing. Mostly for administrators, I imagine. But I was asked to write an article there, and I wrote an article called Teaching the Most Important Academic Subject. And the editor loved it, and subsequently, in effect, got fired for printing it.
Really?
Yeah, because it wasn't an academic subject according to his board, and this was just propaganda from the anti-nuclear fringe.
Poop in Madison.
Yeah. But anyway, he was not asked to renew his contract or something like that. But it was the result of all of this.
Did this course get attention from members of the legislature, pro or con, or was it not an issue?
They couldn't have helped but know that it was going on, because there was a good deal about it in the paper. I never got any.
But it was never denounced.
It was never denounced. Mm-hmm. the way that the Scandinavian Studies Department has been denounced once as being a waste of taxpayers' money.
Well,
teaching. Teaching. Some legislator from God knows where pointed out that this is, you know. He compiled a short list of useless courses that were being taught at the university.
Oh.
And he could just riffle through the timetable and find half a dozen with preposterous titles dealing with preposterous subjects, and Scandinavian Studies was one of them. It may have been old Icelandic that he particularly felt incensed by. But anyway, nothing like that came up with this nuclear course. I forget who the governor was. No, we didn't get any flack of that sort.
Yeah, Tony Earle was governor.
Well, that would be good then. Yeah, from this point of view. Anyway, when did we say we'd stop?
Four.
At four, so it's getting on. In 83, after this course had been launched, I was a featured speaker and a workshop leader at a Midwest conference at Wingspread. The role of the university in addressing nuclear issues, sponsored by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And that's when I met, for the first and only time in my life, Condoleezza Rice, who was there at that particular conference.
No kidding.
Yeah. She was, you know, Harvard. She was teaching at Harvard and was interested in these sorts of subjects. By this time, I was on the Educators for Social Responsibility National Board, and I remained on that board for a couple of years. And then in 84, you're right, this is all mid-80s that this is going on. In 84, I was approached by a professor of history, Russian history professor at the University of Chicago named James Craycraft. And he was one of the editors of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and who they're the ones with the doomsday clock and all of that. And he had been talking to his board, and he'd become aware of what I was doing, the various things that I was active in. And he said, would I be willing to edit for them a 32-page supplement to appear in the magazine as a centerfold thing, 32-page detachable supplement, also to be published separately, about teaching nuclear issues and how to teach them and how to approach them from various disciplines, because that's what I'd done, was got together a staple of people who could talk about how it impinged on their discipline and so on. So I said I would do that. And again, it was a big job, but I had the leads. I knew the people who I could get in touch with. And so this 32-page supplement was done with little articles from anybody you can think of, including journalism professors and everybody, about how you can integrate materials about the nuclear arms race and its dangers and whatnot and so on into courses in any field. Because that's what everybody was talking about in those days. How can you integrate this material into regular courses? Because you aren't going to be able to teach special courses in it like they're doing at Wisconsin right now. Mm-hmm. So this was to give people advice on how to integrate these sorts of materials into courses in departments at any university. And it, in due course, it came out and was widely distributed and I think widely influential. I never thought, if you had asked me in graduate school whether I would ever have anything published in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, I would have laughed.
It's quite astounding, the breadth and depth of your intellect.
Well,
I mean, it really is, Dick. I mean, because you must have been comfortable dealing with the scientists.
Oh yeah. Oh sure. Sure. And I had to. Sorry.
This concludes the December 3rd, 2007 interview with Professor Dick Ringler.